Victory or death!
Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon, the voice of freedom behind enemy lines here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, bringing you, the Patriots, the information you need to stay in the fight to preserve your liberty. This is episode 22-23, and I know that's what I said last week, but I was wrong last week. Last week was 22-22. This one is 22-23. This is actually the 112th episode since the podcast was started back in 2019. And I'd like to thank you, especially if you've been a listener since the beginning, thank you. And if you're a new listener, thank you as well. You can find information about the show at radiofreevirginia.com. You can get show notes and stuff like that, as well as support the show by checking out some of the shirts that are available and buying a shirt, or as well supporting the advertisers. We have a couple different things to talk about. We have some great news on the political front. The Wicked Witch of the Midwest, Liz Cheney, was defeated in a primary. Republican primary, and she was defeated. There were others that didn't win, other conservatives that didn't win, but in her case, she's not a conservative. She's awful, awful human being, awful person. All around, just a horrible person, so good riddance. She does walk away with, from what I hear, around $37 million, only in office for 6 years. 6 years, $175,000, roughly a little over $1 million, not including all the free airfare and travel and private jets and all the other things that come with being a United States representative. But in any case, good riddance to bad rubbish. Good job, Wyoming, or was it Montana? Either case, good job. So anyway, you know, and that's just kind of how it works. And you're able to take that money that was donated to your political campaign and parlay it into other political campaigns and other things and political action committees. And there's all these ways that you can shuffle that money around, kind of like a shell game. The Clintons were great at this. They were the best at this, actually. Another way you might see a book come out written by someone else about a guy or gal, Dreams of My Father, as the former traitor in chief, Barack Obama, wrote or didn't write, actually. Probably written by somebody else. I don't see how he would have had the time to write it. But in any case, it is one way that they funnel money into these individuals' pockets. They ghostwrite a book, and then the book hits the New York Times bestseller list. Not that that many people are buying it. But what happens is that the Democratic Party, buys 10 million copies and sticks them in a warehouse, burns them, uses them for toilet paper, who knows what, gives them away as gifts. Abracadabra, it's a bestseller. Hillary Clinton has had a few of these recently. Don't know why. Nobody's reading that book. Give me a break. I have this great graphic I found that says things that are not conspiracy theories: sex trafficking, government corruption, media manipulation, food modification, etc. Regardless of your political affiliation, this stuff is happening. You're not crazy for believing it. You're really crazy for ignoring it. You know, I would add a few things to that. But I think the point of this is something John Galt, who's been on the show, has said in the past, is that there's enough stuff that's happening right in front of my face that's not a conspiracy theory. I don't need to focus on conspiracy theories. I'm not worried about aliens and the global cabal and them sacrificing and eating babies or whoever, whatever the conspiracy theory is. It doesn't matter, because there's all this craziness happening right in front of our faces that we need to be paying attention to. I'm going to talk about a few of the, not really conspiracy theories, but just the stuff that's happening here. I'm going to share something from our wonderful, not so great, Senator Mark Warner, and make some commentary on that. And also, I'll talk about a few other things, so let's get started. And I want to thank ActiCare of the Blue Ridge for sponsoring this segment of the show. ActiCare is in-home senior care for your senior loved one if you can't be there. If you're in Bedford, Campbell, Amherst, Smith Mountain Lake, Lynchburg, out in the country, get in touch with John and his team at actikare.com/blue-ridge. That's ACTIKARE.com/Blue-Ridge, and they'll take good care of you. All right, first up to share is a letter from Mark Warner, U.S. Senator from the Commonwealth of Virginia. Mark Warner has been in office for over 10 years. I don't know how many millions of dollars he's worth, but I can tell you that's not all from his salary, which is substantial. I don't know if you know this, but congressmen and senators get $175,000 a year. It doesn't include the budget that they have for their office to hire staff, to cover travel, to cover lodging when they're doing their representing us. $175,000 a year. There's a myth that they get a lifetime pension. That's not true. The lifetime pension they get is all the insider trading they get to do while they're in office. So they get to know about stuff that's coming, what benefits it's going to have for companies, what laws are going to get passed before you and I do, what's in those laws. I mean, they don't know what's everything that's in those laws, but they know the things that are going to benefit certain businesses, and they know to call their stock guy and go, hey, I want to buy some of these shares because it's going to make money. So that's how they get rich, if you're wondering. They didn't get rich because they have private businesses. Occasionally, a few of them do. But most of these people have never worked a day in the last minimum 20 years. They've been freeloading off of you and me and doing what they do best, which is ripping us all off. So here we go. I know there's a lot of news coming out of Washington recently, so I wanted to take a few minutes to briefly recap what I've gotten done for Virginians this year and what's next. Uh-oh, hold on to your hats, people. Or hold on to your wallets, I should say. To lower costs for you. Ha! You know when a politician says to lower anything, it's going to be the opposite. In fact, everything, as I read this, think of the opposite. If he says major win, it's a major loss. If he says it's going to cost you less, it's going to cost you more. So here we go. I'm extremely concerned by rising costs at the pump, pharmacy, and stores. A few weeks ago, we had a major win I've been fighting for to ease supply chains and cut costs by making more semiconductors in America. Blah, 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 blah. You know how many times I've heard this? I've lost count of how many times the government has stepped in to help. How many times they're going to help us out. They're helping. I'm helping. No, you're not helping. And you don't actually ever deliver on what you say. And they say, oh, you know, we're making sure that, you know, businesses pay their fair share, except that now they're doing things to kick back. And, you know, I'm all for, you know, semiconductors. I'm all for everything moving back into the United States. So we need to reshore, not offshore, our stuff. I'm cool with that. Create incentives that makes that happen. And don't be shelling out cash, which is what they'll be doing. With this signed into law, we'll start producing more of the microchips that power all our electronics here at home, which will help. Yeah, well, we're not making them here, so what does that matter? I mean, okay, seriously, a serious question. You're going to make more microchips here, so what? We don't make anything here. It's all made in Taiwan, Thailand, Singapore. You name the Asian country, India. It sure as heck not made in America. So what if you make more semiconductors here? Whoopity-doo. Which will help strengthen our national security and drive down costs. Lie. We also just passed a law that will majorly incentivize domestic energy production, including, and here's the reality, green energy, so we can lower gas and power bills. You know who this benefits? You know who makes solar panels and windmills? Yeah, China. We don't make those. We don't make those here. So if we're going to spend all this investment, we're going to incentivize domestic energy production. Except we're not doing that. We're not incentivizing the exploration of oil. We're not incentivizing companies to use the leases that they have, which they're not allowed to use. What a liar. To address health costs, I champion provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act. Yeah, $800 billion. I want to know how I can get some of that. Can I have a billion of it? Imagine what you or I or anybody, any free American could do with $1 billion and how much that would actually help the economy. Now, it wouldn't lower inflation. Think about that. If I had $1 billion and we all had just billions of dollars, it would not lower inflation. And that's what the government has. The government just decided to print $800 billion. They don't have $800 billion. So they're going to spend that $800 billion and everything is going to cost more because they're buying more stuff. So the government had a shortage of, created a shortage of baby formula. Remember that? They created shortages of all kinds of things and they create shortages every year by screwing with the free market. To lower premiums, cap out-of-pocket costs for seniors, and allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices. They were already doing that. This is more of those political lies. They're always doing this stuff. They're such liars. The provision in these laws may not bring down costs overnight or ever, but they're meaningful steps towards stabilizing our economy and providing relief at the register. What a bunch of malarkey. I'm not even done with this thing yet. It just keeps on going. And it is such a bunch of lies. Now, let me tell you something about Medicare. If you're not over 65, I believe it is. When you get over 65, get ready to pay. Get ready to pay big. Because you need Medicare. Oh, and then you're going to have to get this other Medicare and supplemental insurance. And then this other supplemental insurance, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Go hang out with your parents sometime. Watch the shows that they watch, the old folk shows, you know, Murder, She Wrote and, you know, Rockford Files. Cool show, by the way. And you'll see all these stupid Medicare ads. And you're like, this doesn't make any sense. So I was asking my stepmom about this. And she was taking care of my dad. And we're all sitting there. And she's like, oh, yeah, we got this and this and this and this. And we got the best thing. And we got da-da-da-da-da. So it was such a lie. It's a lie. I'm not helping people. To build an economy that works for all, equity. Or is it equality? No, they want equity. It's critical to me to build an economy and public services that work for all Virginians. On this front, I helped broker a historic infrastructure law that will create jobs, restore dilapidated roads and bridges, liar, and improve services like airports and public transportation. How about the free market to do that? How about these companies actually have to do their job or they go out of business? Oh, no, we're not going to do that. We're gonna gosh, we can't not subsidize them. What are you talking about? I've got a webpage explaining some of what we've already secured for projects here in the Commonwealth, and I expect that Virginia will keep receiving grants over the next decade for all sorts of projects as a result of this landmark accomplishment. Yay! So as you're driving up to hang out at Busch Gardens or go to Virginia Beach, you can perpetually, for the next 10 to 20 years, be sitting in some infrastructure project that never ends. Thanks, Mark Warner. What would we do without you? You're so great. Gosh. You ever notice that? You go up to Northern Virginia and it's just always construction. It never ends. It never ends. There's never not construction on the road. Well, you have to slow down because it's a road construction zone. It's always a road. What are you talking about? When is there not construction here? I frankly don't know how people live up there. I think the greatest time is when I'd have to go do service calls up in Northern Virginia during the pandemic because there was never traffic because nobody was working. I'm also working to make taxes more fair and your interactions with the IRS more efficient and less frustrating. Yeah, by hiring 87,000 agents. Ha ha. That's why I fought for better funding for the IRS so they can finally afford the modern tech and in-person staff they need to provide better customer service, process returns, and get your tax refunds quicker. We're also working to make sure that the wealthiest Americans, and the biggest corporations are paying their fair share, lowering our deficit by over $300 billion in the process. What he doesn't tell you, what he doesn't tell you here is that they are spending $800 billion for all the things that he's talking about, but they're lowering the deficit by $300 billion. So that means they're increasing the deficit by $500 billion and calling it a win because they lowered it by $300 billion somehow, magically, fictionally, whatever. Here's how that's probably happening. They're probably coming up with some bogus, tax thing where they run the calculations and they assume people are working and this is the job numbers now and blah, blah, blah. And so when it all shakes out, though, I guarantee you that not only will you not see that deficit reduction by $300 billion, you will actually see an increase of probably $1 trillion. By the time this is all said and done, and they spent their $800 billion, yada, yada, that's you're not going to see any deficit reduction. Deficit reduction is a joke. They don't care about that. It's not part of Washington's monetary fiscal policy. This is not possible. A couple more things. To keep Americans safe, public safety and national security are top of mind for me. Public safety and national security are top of mind for me. So they wrote this wrong. Duh. It's why I serve as the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. In the past year, we've worked incredibly hard to strengthen global alliances and to get aid to Ukraine so they can stand in opposition to Russia's illegal invasion. I've also been getting important legislation done to support access to benefits for veterans to build an additional veterans care facility in Virginia. Well, that would be great. You know what we could do? We could actually service the veterans with the facilities we have by actually serving the veterans instead of pretending to serve the veterans. Nobody wants to go to the VA. And they continue to say, we've solved the problem. We fixed it. And he says, but wait, there's more. I also voted for the most impactful gun safety legislation in 30 years to keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers and get more support for mental health care. And we click the link to that gun legislation. Let's see. Oh, it's a Twitter link. What an idiot. You put the link to the actual thing? Oh, it's a video of this moron talking. Ugh. And it's got a bunch of comments here. One says, tyrant, period. Well, you know what happens to tyrants. Keep it up, Mark. To protect freedoms and rights of Virginians, in April I voted to confirm a tremendously qualified and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Barf. It says, and their pets. I'm not leaving our four-legged Virginians behind either. After reports of abuse at Envigo Breeding and Research Facility in Cumberland, I called for federal investigations, and now 4,000 beagles are being adopted into loving homes across the country. You can thank Virginia state representatives for doing something about this, not this turd. I'm sick and tired of this. This is what the NRA does. NRA comes, look what we did. We passed, you know, our people passed this new legislation. You didn't do anything. It was a Virginia Citizens Defense League. He didn't do anything here. It was guys like Senator Bill Stanley and others fighting to solve this problem and to get these beagles adopted. So annoying. While it's been a remarkably productive year, a lot remains to be done. I look forward to voting to protect marriage equality in September. Barf. I'm disappointed that some of my colleagues have obstructed common sense action to protect the right to vote and to access health care. Remember what I said. Don't believe a word this guy says. Believe the opposite of everything he says. If he wants to protect the right to vote, he wants to hinder honest vote. If he wants to protect access to healthcare, he wants to screw it up more than it's already screwed up. If you're involved in the healthcare industry, you know, and if you have to take part in the healthcare industry, you know how screwed up it is. But I'll keep speaking out on these issues and pushing for progress. I also shepherded a bill to provide student debt relief to victims of financial and domestic abuse unanimously. Student debt relief? What does that have to do with anything? How is it the government's job to help you with your choices and your debts and things? No matter what, I'm going to keep pushing for real solutions that help lower the costs, keep Virginians safe, and protect our freedoms. If you want to share your thoughts about an issue that's important to you, you can send me an email anytime by using the form on my Senate website. You can also follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I look forward to hearing from you. Senator Mark Warner, millionaire. Multi-millionaire. I wonder how much Mark Warner's worth. Let's look that up. All right, Mark Warner. How much is Mark Warner worth? Let's take a look. Net worth, personal finances. This is a website called Open Secrets. Mark Warner ranks first in the Senate. I kid you not. The first. He is the richest senator from a 2018. And a lot of this stuff has several years of delay before we find out what's real. So an estimated net worth of $214 million. He has $16 million in securities and investments, $3 million telecom services, a bunch of ETFs, $16 million, and looks like another investment portfolio, $16 million. And it doesn't actually say... You know, where the, so 214, that's short by over $100 million. So I don't know where all his money is tied up. So it says, this is interesting. And it lets you click down the years. So I'm going to go through year by year. 2017, 253 million. So he actually lost some money. 2015, 238 million. Yeah, you know, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars here, so it's really easy to move forward and come back. But in any case, 2014, 242 million. 2013, he had 254 million. He's holding pretty steady here. And 2012, 257 million. So he's actually lost a little bit of money. If you want to go poke around his finances, you can do that at this link. You can find that in the show notes. I'm kind of done talking about him. He's an idiot. And Virginians are idiots for continuing to reelect him. He's a scumbag. And now he's the richest United States senator in the entire nation. There's Nancy Pelosi, you know, she's only worth $114 million. That's the interesting thing. You know, everyone talks about that person that they see in the front, but then they don't talk about, you know, who these other people are, like Mark Warner. So maybe time to get him out of office, but that's going to be pretty tough when he has that much money. That's just the equivalent of Donald Trump, you know, running for president. He's got billions of dollars. Well, this jerk has, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. He could put $50 million into a campaign and blow everybody, all of his competition, out of the water. And obviously, he's not in the position where he needs the money at this point. I don't know where his money came from. But guys like him, you know, they don't go away. They're like a cancer, and he's not in it for the money. He's in it for the power. So I don't know what to do. You know, we got to get good guys. You know, we've had opportunities to replace him. The problem is that one of those was Ed Gillespie. I called him Dead Fish Gillespie because I think I would have rather had a dead fish as my representative than that schmuck. So that's the problem. We got guys like that. Terrible, awful guys. Speaking of, I don't want to compare Glenn Youngkin to Ed Gillespie, but Glenn Youngkin has done nothing. He beat Terry McAuliffe. That's it. And he didn't even do it. A steaming pile of dog poo could have run against that guy after what we experienced with Ralph Northam, and I think we probably would have won. So stop this nonsense that we should, Glenn Youngkin's a real contender for president of the United States. You know, maybe in the next 2024 election, you know, maybe he could win instead of Donald Trump. We could put him up there and blah, 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 blah. He's done nothing. What has he done? Name me one thing that Glenn Youngkin has done. One. What's he done? He became governor. Whoa. What would he do? He became governor. Well, therefore, we should make him president. Give me a break. What has he done? I can't think of a thing. I'm glad to have him there. Glad a Republican is in office. But he's a new guy. He hasn't done anything. And he doesn't have any real power to do much because we don't control the legislature. So moving on, I guess. So I want to bring something up. I'm not going to do a deep dive or talk a lot about this, but it's called ESG. It's just an acronym they've given it. And essentially, it means environmental, social, and governance. And it is a score that they're giving companies and sometimes penalizing companies for their ESG score. Is if you're not doing enough, you know, social, Black Lives Matter, gay pride parade stuff, then you lose points on the social side. If you're not doing enough for your green initiatives, you know, putting solar panels on your buildings and whatever, you get a down score in environmental. And then there's other things with governance. I'm not going to do a deep dive. I just want you to be aware of this. Start listening for this because I've started to hear this more and more when people are on the news, business owners, and people talking about ESG. So it's something you need to be aware of. This is another one of those global elite stupid ideas. It's a stupid idea. You know, the free market decides what a good company is and what a bad company is. It's supposed to decide that. Didn't really decide that with Enron. That just got sold and I think became Lehman Brothers or Bank of Evil. I can't remember. But these things, you know, if you're big enough, they don't really matter anyway. There's no free market. In a lot of ways, we don't have that. We have I think it's called an oligarchy. We have something of that sort. Kleptocracy? I'm not really sure. We certainly don't have a republic at the moment. We continue reading with Soviet Life, and this is the Reader's Ask section. And the question is, are Soviet communists more privileged than non-party people? To judge by your own Soviet sources, they are not. But that's hard to believe since the Communist Party of the Soviet Union is the ruling party. And the answer says, the communists have no privileges except one, to give more than anybody else to the common cause and to fight and work better than anybody else for its triumph. Nor do the communists have any special rights except one, to be wherever it is more difficult to be. These are great. These words of Leonid Brezhnev, General Secretary of the Central Committee of the CPSU, express the true role of communists. Membership does not give anyone in the Soviet Union any particular privileges. As citizens, communists obey the same laws as non-party people. This applies to every type of contact the people have with the state and the community. Communists and non-party persons have an equal right to elect and to be elected to national governing bodies, the Soviets of the People's Deputies, or any other elective bodies. The same principles are enforced when people get paid for their work according to their skills and the quantity and quality of the work done, are admitted to colleges or universities upon passing competitive examinations, or are provided with housing and granted benefits and payments from the social funds. Now, let's look at a couple of these things that they talked about here. So they have competitive tests to get into university. But I thought, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. And if you applied that the way it should be applied, shouldn't the person who's stupider get to have more opportunity to go to college because he has a greater need because he's a dummy? Shouldn't that guy get all the benefits and get ahead? They clearly aren't applying communism as we know it and see it. The other one I like here is it says, according to their skills and quantity and quality of the work done in regards to, you know, getting paid. We know that that's not how communism works. But yet it did. And yet it does. So it's interesting. They're liars. But that's what they do. There are uniform standards that govern the size of personal property in the USSR. For example, a communist collective farmer will have the same kind of subsidiary smallholding as a non-party rural resident. There are uniform laws governing military service, taxation, and other duties of citizens, whether communists or not. Do individual party members ever try to get extra rights and privileges? Some do. With the CPSU having so large a membership, upward of 17.4 million at present, and with communists differing in levels of consciousness, this is unavoidable. But the CPSU is intolerant of any deviation by communists from the accepted standards of party life. There was a changeover of party cards in 1973. The membership cards, issued 17 years before and due to expire, were exchanged for new cards, which are to remain valid until 1994. An important effect of the exchange was to strengthen the exacting attitude that communists must maintain towards each other. The party organizations made a special point of excluding whoever might be unworthy of the name communists. The changeover contributed towards consolidation, greater activity, and better discipline. Now, this is interesting. We've seen this before. If you remember from I Led Three Lives, this is the kind of thing they do. The overwhelming majority of CPSU members honestly fulfill their vanguard role in the community. Indeed, there is no area of activity without communists in the forefront who set good examples. For instance, there is communist involvement in major projects in the remote regions of the country, in Siberia, the Far East, the Far North, and the deserts of Central Asia. Whenever there are mineral deposits to open up, a big factory or a high-power electric station to erect, a railroad to build, or a vast tract of wasteland to cultivate, communists are the first to undertake the job, and they do so not under orders, but simply in response to the party's appeal and at the bidding of their own hearts. I mean, it's hard to believe that people would believe this rubbish. It was during the Second World War that communists gave a particular striking display of their vanguard role on the front lines. Communists went into battles as volunteers. Thousands. We've seen movies of this. Enemy at the Gates. Yeah. See what happens when you don't volunteer. Thousands of full-time party workers, secretaries of regional, city, and district party committees, nearly one-third of the CPSU Central Committee, and many secretaries of the Central Committees of the Communist Parties of the Republics joined the combatant army. There were 1.3 million communists enrolled by late 1941. In the subsequent years of the war, their number on the front lines rose. Leonid Brezhnev, too, spent almost all 4 years of the war at the front. Here are a few small lines from his book. This is perhaps the point to recall that 3 million communists fell valiantly at the fronts of the Great Patriotic War. 5 million Soviet patriots joined the party during the war years. I heard the words now legendary. I want to go into battle a communist. Before practically every battle, and the tougher the fighting was, the more often it was heard. What privileges could a person look forward to? What rights could the party give him the day before a brutal, destructive battle? Only one privilege. Only one right. Only one duty. To be the first to attack. The first to rush forward in the face of withering fire. The first thing we must note regarding the claim that all important posts are held by party members in the Soviet Union is that this is factually inaccurate. For example, the present membership of the USSR Supreme Soviet, the nation's top legislature, you know, I'm not going to talk about that because they talked about that last week. Of course, most leading posts are held by communists in our country for a very important reason. The party unites within its ranks those who see their service to the people and their community as the most important thing in their lives. The Communist Party has concentrated the nation's leading persons, its cream, its intellect, its honor, and conscience. That's good stuff. I mean, just it's just ridiculous. But you can see the propaganda and you can see the same kind of nonsense they're peddling now. Now we move on to the doctrine of the lesser magistrates. If you didn't get a chance, I would recommend you go back to the episode last week and listen to the introduction and explanation of what this is. I will read the entire thing and then I will have my commentary afterwards. The Doctrine Defined, Chapter 1. In 39 AD, Publius Petronius, who was the Roman governor of Syria and Palestine, received an order from his superior, Caligula, the Emperor of Rome. Caligula, who was convinced of his own divinity, ordered Petronius to assemble half his army and install an image of himself in the Jewish temple at Jerusalem. Petronius had the statue of the emperor made in Sidon and prepared his troops while he wintered in Ptolemais. To the Jews, a statue of the emperor in the temple was a severe affront to their religion. The Jews therefore sent numerous delegations during this time to protest before the governor concerning the law of the emperor. Petronius was so deeply moved by the reasoning of their protests that he wrote to Caligula that he would not enforce his order, and entreated the emperor to annul it. When Emperor Caligula received the letter from Governor Petronius, he became outraged and ordered Petronius to commit suicide. Soon after, however, Caligula was assassinated by his Praetorian guards. Fortunately for Petronius, the ship carrying the order for him to commit suicide arrived after the ship carrying the news of the emperor's assassination. The statue was never placed in the temple. Though Governor Petronius would have not known it as such, he was practicing what would later be termed by reformers such as John Calvin, Christopher Goodman, and John Knox as the doctrine of the lesser magistrates. We call it a doctrine because it is a Christian doctrine, first formalized by the pastors of Magdeburg, Germany. The word magistrate is an old term referring to any civil government with authority, either elected or appointed. The lesser magistrate doctrine declares that when the superior or higher civil authority makes unjust, immoral laws or decrees, the lesser or lower ranking civil authority has both a right and a duty to refuse obedience to that superior authority. If necessary, the lesser authorities even have the right and obligation to actively resist the superior authority. For example, if Congress, the President, or the United States Supreme Court makes an unjust or immoral law or decree, a state legislature or governor could stand in defense of their unjust law or decree and refuse to obey or implement it. Those lesser magistrates could, in fact, actively oppose such a law or decree. Even a city council or mayor could appropriately defy an unjust law or decree handed down by any higher authority. A memorable statement that serves as a summary for the doctrine of the lesser magistrate actually came from a higher magistrate, Roman Emperor Trajan. While appointing a subordinate authority, handed him a sword and instructed him, saying, "Use this sword against my enemies if I give righteous commands, but if I give unrighteous commands, use it against me." Historically, this doctrine was practiced before the time of Christ and Christianity, but it was Christian men who formalized and embedded it into their political institutions throughout Western civilization. For example, the nobles who stood on the field of Runnymede in England to take King John's tyranny to task in the year 1215 were Christian men. These lesser magistrates forced the tyrant king to sign a treaty acknowledging certain rights for men. The Magna Carta stood in defiance of tyranny and oppression, and made clear that the state has limitations, and that all are subject to the law, even government officials. That great document, Magna Carta, was the product of a Christian culture. The Magna Carta played an important role in the historical process that led to the rule of constitutional law in the English-speaking world. Certain unjust and immoral actions by King John, along with his fiscal tyranny through taxation and fees, caused the nobles who were functioning as lesser magistrates to defy his higher authority. King John signed that document, giving the people of England their cherished rights only because of the combined swords of the lesser magistrates who gathered to demand its signing. Calvin spoke of the lesser magistrate doctrine in his Institutes of the Christian Religion. Amazingly, he did not appeal to Scripture in his support of it. Rather, he appealed to pagan historical examples. But other reformers did give a scriptural foundation to the doctrine. John Knox, for example, in his Appellation written to the nobles of Scotland in 1558, cites over 70 passages of scripture to support the doctrine. Knox insisted that the nobles, as lesser magistrates, were responsible to protect the innocent and to oppose those who made unjust laws or decrees. The teaching by Christian men about the lesser magistrate, God's sovereignty, covenant, the nature of man, and church government shaped the views of Western civilization that birthed constitutional governments. In what would become the United States, the lesser magistrate doctrine had a huge impact upon the thinking of our founders and upon our nation's people regarding government and law. Today, however, neither the magistrates nor the people know this doctrine, as America's pietistic infected pulpits have long been silent regarding it. If ever this nation needs to understand the lesser magistrate doctrine, it is now. The attacks upon the law of God are ferocious and relentless. The preborn are murdered, and sodomy is proliferated. Immoral and unjust edicts are commonplace. The assault upon our freedom and liberties seems to be a daily undertaking by those in high office. But one thing has not changed. The lesser magistrate has a duty before God to uphold the good regardless of the new definitions of law created by the state. Historically, the practice of the church has been that when the state commands that which God forbids and forbids that which God commands, men have a duty to obey God rather than man. The Bible clearly teaches this principle. The lesser magistrate is to apply this principle to his office as magistrate. When an unjust decree is made by a higher authority, the lesser magistrate must choose to either join the higher magistrate in his rebellion against God or to stand with God in opposition to the unjust or immoral decree. The lesser magistrate doctrine is clearly founded in Scripture and seen in history, and it is actively exercised in our daily life. In a later chapter, we will look at how the lesser magistrates are utilizing their authority against federal tyranny in our nation today, as well as look at the need for future action by the lesser magistrates in order to rein in federal government that has spurned its constitutional restraints. As our nation continues to sink into rebellion, immorality, and depravity, the lesser magistrate doctrine needs to be explained both to the magistrates themselves and to the people of our country. So it's an easy read, and I would recommend you get this book. I posted a link last week in the show notes. It really does a good job of explaining the history of this doctrine as well as how it can be applied today And you'll learn more and more as I go on. I'm, every week I'm going to read a chapter. But I wanted to kind of talk about this in our country as we see it. And this is how I explain our government to modern people. modern as in modernity. The postmodern and modern people in our society. When I talk to them about government, because there are some, especially in the Christian church, that think we should just bow down, roll over, let the tanks drive over our skulls and crush us to death. You know, that. So honestly, that's the attitude, that we're subservient to them, that we owe our fealty to them. And that's not the way America has ever been structured. America is structured that complete opposite of every other nation. There isn't a nation like America anywhere in the world. We are sovereign. We are the sovereigns. These people everywhere that are lesser magistrates and higher authorities, they serve us. They are our servants. We are their masters. And yet, government and the elites have done a good job of turning this over on its head. And when we see people, politicians, you know, whatever it is, all of this is upside down. Why were the founders justified to rebel against the government of their day? They didn't have a constitution. They did have an agreement and an understanding and laws that were immutable and unchangeable, that came from things like the Magna Carta, that came from other documents, that came as a result of them coming to the colonies. They had rights, and England was disobeying the law. And so they had an absolute, which we're going to talk about. He talks about that in the book. But they had a right, and I would say they had a duty to rebel, to say, no, no more. We're not doing this anymore. And if you have ever researched and read and learned, watch the show Adams, John Adams, and watch The Patriot. If you watch these, I think you'll get a really good picture of what was going on in the day and the justification for it. But ultimately, it comes down to this. Government is put there to do good. When government, by God, when government doesn't do good, it is not doing what it was put there to do, and we don't have to obey that. It's that simple. When government comes and they want to entrap you and kick down your door and make up stuff about you and haul you off to the gulag, you don't have to just go, well, aw shucks. See you later, Ma. That's stupid. And if you think that, you need to really, I'm not going to call you stupid. I'm going to call you ignorant. You're ignorant. You need to learn what we have, this wonderful gift that we have to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that it is unalienable. You can't give it away. You can't mortgage it. It's yours. Tough luck. And that's why communism is illegal, not allowed under our system of government. It's illegal. Now, I guess if you could abolish the Constitution, you can then have communism. And until then, you can't, because we are guaranteed, all of us, a republic, a republican form of government. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about the FBI. There's been a lot of talk about this, with them raiding Trump's house and doing what they're doing. I want to share with you a quick little clip here. This is a reporter named Cheryl Atkinson, and this isn't the first place we've ever heard of a story like this, where somebody, and in this case, the FBI, probably the NSA or somebody there, I mean, I don't know, but somebody in the government in a law enforcement capacity illegally invading someone's computer, in this case, a reporter. I mean, gosh, I thought the First Amendment was sacrosanct, you know, right? And making all kinds of crazy threats. So I'm going to play this audio, and I'd really like to know what you think about this. This is a testimony she was giving, and I will post this link to this article at radiofreevirginia.com. Have a listen.
May I say, one little reported facet of my case is one of the federal agents involved in one of the operations against me said that they intended to plant child porn in my husband's computer. This is the FBI. There's been a case that's currently in litigation, unrelated, in which an FBI agent has testified that they did that. They have done that. It was not accomplished in my case. I guess the curtain was drawn on that facet of the operation prior to them doing it. But imagine how you ever get out of that. How you they knew we had a young daughter at home and had allegedly conspired to do that.
I think there have been calls recently to disband the FBI, and I think they're spot on. It's just time. This organization has been corrupt from the beginning. It has metastasized into a evil, monstrous cancer in our law enforcement world, and it's time for it to go. The FBI doesn't do a single backwards-looking investigation. What I mean by that is someone breaks into your house, backwards-looking, you investigate that crime. Everything they do is forwards-looking. How can we make sure this person breaks the law? How can we trap this person into lying to us? How can we plant child porn on their computer and say, hey, you better come work for us or we're going to tell everybody about this child porn that you don't know anything about, but we don't know how it got there magically. This isn't the first time I've heard stories like this. Stuart Rose caught them messing around in his computer years back. And I'm sure it's probably happened to Alex Jones and happened to many others. They don't do what is right. They're evil. And this is why I say, don't talk to them when they come to your door. If the FBI comes knocking on your door, excuse me, sir, we'd like to ask you some questions. First of all, don't open the door. Do not open the door. Say, I don't answer questions. Get off my property. Well, yeah, but we need to clear some things up. Come back with a warrant. Bye. You'll regret it. I'm going to tell you right now, you will regret it. I've known people that know these things and that end up talking to the police or talking and doing stupid junk and getting themselves into trouble. And they didn't even do anything. So don't do it. Don't talk to them. They're not your friends. You're not buddies with them. You're not going to be able to clear it up. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. It won't be used for you. It'll be used against you. So don't open yourself up to that. It's dumb. I mean, I don't know how many times I've had to say this, but I've known people that have gotten into trouble. And you ask any lawyer who's honest, and he will tell you, don't ever talk to the police. Don't ever talk to law enforcement. Lawyer. They put you in cuffs and they sit you down. Hey, let's clear this up right now. Maybe we can just, work this out. Lawyer. Take me to jail. I want my lawyer. Shut up. You want to mock them? Call them tyrants? Agents of tyranny? You want to have fun with that? Fine, do that, because that's probably what I'll do. But don't talk to them. Don't say anything. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. It can't be used for you. It just can't. Well, fall is fast approaching, and I'm super excited about that. I love me some fall. I can't stand the summer. The more that goes on, I just can't stand it. I like the time at the pool. Pool time is fun. Occasional beach trip's pretty cool, but not a big fan. I like the fall. I like the spring and the fall. I don't mind the winter, but I like the fall and I like spring. So it won't be long now. If you're getting up in the morning early, which I recommend, you can get out and watch the sunrise and go for a quick little walk out in the cooler weather before it gets hot. It's kind of nice. Well, I'd like to thank you for listening and remind you, you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.